From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. If you believe enough in God, will it make you rich? This week, we talk about faith.
I needed to bring a certain amount of money. That's when I began to see that it wasn't as humble as it appeared to be. It was a business.
An investigation into a mega Brazilian prosperity church. And a mother tells us about the time she had to pray the hardest.
The doctor said, if we let nature run its course, your children will be born now, the second, and nobody in the Dominican Republic will be able to save your babies.
And we ask whether or not a drop in deportations means Latinos should renew their faith in Obama.
He promised the first year of his presidency to give us immigration reform, and here we are in his second term and still nothing.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're talking faith. And in a minute, we'll hear from Cokie Roberts and her take on the new pope. But first, as both Democrats and Republicans know, the Latino vote was essential to reelecting President Obama in 2012. But the Obama administration has been responsible for a record number of deportations, on track to reach 2 million in 2014. But last year, deportations fell slightly, which raises the question, should advocates renew their faith in Mr. Obama's promise for immigration reform? From Washington, Matt Laszlo reports.
Grace Martinez is undocumented, but America is the only home she's ever known.
I came to the country when I was 2 months old. My father was a Baptist minister, a small business owner, and my mother was a stay-at-home mom.
Martinez is 25. She hasn't seen her father in 6 years. He was arrested one Labor Day.
He didn't make a complete stop at a stop sign. He was stopped, and he didn't have a driver's license, so he was detained for a week and later deported.
Martinez has two younger sisters who are both U.S. citizens, while she, another sister, and her mom remain here undocumented. Martinez says after her dad was deported, the family had to wrestle with a tough question.
There was a point in that year where my family had to make a choice of whether we would sacrifice the American dream that they had given up everything for to go to Mexico and be with him. But I think our family decision was just to honor that dream for us to be able to stay and finish college.
Martinez is now an organizer with United We Dream, the nation's largest network of undocumented youths pushing for immigration reform. She's upset with President Obama's deportation policy. She says the immigrant community helped keep Mr. Obama in the White House, but he has yet to deliver on his campaign promises.
He promised the first year of his presidency to give us immigration reform, and here we are in his second term and still nothing.
In fact, the president's immigration policies displease people across the political spectrum. Congressional Democrats are up in arms over the record number of deportations the Obama administration has made, nearly 2 million by the end of last year. 29 Democrats recently signed a letter asking for deportations of non-criminals to be halted. One was Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva. He says aggressive deportations haven't won the president a single Republican ally in Congress.
What that policy is was intended to is to try to prove to the more conservative elements of this Congress that you could do enforcement at that level. And if that was the carrot, nobody's chewing on it.
Grijalva says the administration has fallen into a catch-22.
And now they find themselves with no political response on the other side and owning a policy that has deported more people than in the history of this country.
While many Republicans do support the president's deportation policy, others are critical. Florida Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart has been working with a bipartisan group of lawmakers to craft immigration reform in the House. He says the president can't be trusted on this issue. That's partly why members of his party are resisting the comprehensive immigration bill passed by the Senate last year.
He is there, like he has in multiple areas, breaking his word. He said that he was not going to deport folks that didn't have serious criminal records. He's deporting record numbers of people, many of which have families in the United States and that have not committed serious crimes.
There could be movement on immigration reform this year. how Speaker John Boehner continues to support tackling immigration reform in a piecemeal fashion. He recently hired a former aide to Senator John McCain, which immigration activists say bodes well for their cause. In the meantime, Illinois Democratic Congressman Luis Gutierrez argues the president should stop breaking apart immigrant families through deportations.
This is not amnesty. This is not a permanent solution. This is a temporary solution that allows you to say, I'm going to protect you in the place you're at right now. You don't get to travel. You don't get to vote. You just get to stay with your family in a safe place.
The immigration reform effort is complicated by this year's midterm elections. Some reform advocates hope House Republicans will be more open to compromise after primary season, though many rank-and-file House Republicans come from conservative districts that don't have many Latino voters, and they tend to oppose reform. But GOP leaders concerned with national elections continue to call for it. So now it's a waiting game to see whether Mr. Obama is remembered as the president who tackled immigration reform or the one who carried out a record number of deportations. For Latino USA, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
We've been talking about matters of faith today, and unless you've been living under a rock, you've probably heard some of the coverage about this man.
Pope Francis is Time Magazine's Person of the Year.
Today, Pope Francis denounced trickle-down economics as unfair to the poor.
I think free market capitalism is a great liberator.
Ah! You're going up against the Pope?
Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the first pope from Latin America, has made waves with his message of compassion with less judgment. He's been caught sneaking out of the Vatican to help the homeless, and of course, he's never worn those red shoes. We wanted to get a bit more perspective on the political and institutional implications of the pope's reign, so we invited Cokie Roberts, NPR and ABC News contributor, and a Catholic, to join us on Latino USA. Welcome back to Latino USA, Cokie.
So nice to talk to you, Maria.
So, Cokie, we want to start off by talking about my relationship to the Catholic Church, which is complicated.
Most people's is.
Okay, and that makes me feel better already. I am no longer practicing, but I was raised Catholic, but I have many members of my family in Mexico that are very devoutly Catholic. So if my relationship and perhaps many Latinos' relationship to the Catholic Church is complicated, what about you?
Well, I am still a practicing Catholic, and I feel very strongly connected to the Catholic Church. But of course, there are areas where I disagree strongly, and the whole exclusion of women from the church has been something very hurtful. I was raised by the wonderful Order of Sacred Heart Nuns, and they feel a lot more hurt than I do, you can be sure, by this exclusion. But there are too many connections for me to be a person who can walk away.
Probably now, across the board, people who you're talking to, Catholic or not, Republican or Democrat, they're probably saying to you, so this Pope, oh my God. I mean, suddenly people want to talk about this Pope the way no one's wanted to talk about a Pope for several decades now.
That's true. And he is very exciting. It was fascinating to cover his election, sitting up on the roof of the Santo Spirito Hospital in Vatican City. And none of us had him on our list of papabile. So I'm frantically pulling out the clippings and say, oh, Argentina, how interesting. And wait, Jesuit. That's fascinating. He is a big deal. And the reason I think people are excited about him is because it's been so sleepy and so restrictive out of the Vatican. It was just so much a different tone of I'm one of you. And those among us who are the least among us are also us. And we have to pay particular attention to them.
Within local parishes, what do you think it means to have young Catholics looking up and seeing a pope that represents Latin America? And, well, they may think things Latino.
Well, I think it's bound to be tremendously important. It's always important to have somebody that you can identify with, which is why the absence of women is so important to more than half of the human race. But to have someone who speaks your language, who understands your culture, at least to some degree, much more so than a German who was the last pope, or a Pole who was the pope before that. And look, if it were not for American Latinos, the Catholic Church would no longer be at a quarter of the population.
Let's take it to politics, Cokie. What does it do in terms of the conversation around immigration reform? The fact that it hasn't happened, might not happen. But you've got a Pope saying these are who you should be identifying with: the poor, the disadvantaged, the disenfranchised, the immigrants.
All of these issues have been there: healthcare, immigration, what's called the preferential option for the poor. But they have taken a back seat in political terms from the bishop's lobbying arm to things like abortion and gay marriage. I think this Pope has set a tone that says, hey, pull immigration reform out from the bottom of the pile and put it on the top of the pile.
So, Cokie, there are some people who have a lot of skepticism about this Pope, and they are kind of waiting for the shoe to drop about what will be revealed. There is a certain amount of mystery around the Pope's time as head of the Jesuit Order of Priests in Argentina during the Dirty War. So what about this behind-the-scenes part of his history that seems to be quite mysterious and we don't know enough about? Is there something there?
Look, what we have been able to learn about Bergoglio's time during the Dirty War was that he was not an accomplice of the regime, but that he was not a martyr to the regime and not a real fighter against the regime. Now, he was young. He himself says it was ridiculous for him to be in that position at that point in his life. But he was not the bravest person you might want to see, but he was also not an accomplice.
Cokie Roberts, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
So good to be with you.
Cokie Roberts is a contributor to Morning Edition on NPR, as well as ABC News. And now it's time for a bocadito, a little morsel of news about a man whose faith in the system has been tested and confirmed. The Supreme Court of California made big news on January 4th. It admitted an undocumented immigrant to the California State Bar Association. 34-year-old Sergio Garcia was born in Mexico and brought to the U.S. twice, once as an infant and again when he was 17. After graduating from Cal Northern School of Law in 2009 and passing the California bar exam, Garcia received a note from the bar that he could not become a lawyer due to his pending immigration status. That is, until Governor Jerry Brown signed a law on January 1st that permits the state courts to grant individual law licenses regardless of immigration status. Days later, the Supreme Court of California decided unanimously to allow Garcia to practice law in California despite his lack of a green card, making him the nation's first undocumented lawyer.
Well, I have an incredible feeling of relief. You know, I feel a weight lifted off my shoulders. It's, like I said, again, it's been a fight that's been ongoing. I was joking with my family because it took me a lot longer to win this case than it took me to get my law degree.
Garcia says he already knows what kind of law he wants to practice.
I'm going to stick with what I know, which is civil litigation, mainly personal injury, auto accidents, stuff like that. Contrary to popular belief, I will not be delving into immigration.
Now, technically, according to federal law, Garcia can only practice if he does so without receiving money from clients. Also, the court's ruling does not mean that any undocumented immigrant can practice law. There are similar ongoing and unresolved cases in both Florida and in New York. To hear an extended interview with Sergio Garcia, visit our website, latinousa.org. And coming up, a Latino USA investigation into a controversial megachurch based in Brazil. Prosperity churches. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. When it comes to religion, Latinos are traditionally thought of as Catholics. But one in five Latinos living in the U.S. are Protestants, many of them Pentecostals. A Brazil-based megachurch, known in Spanish as La Iglesia Universal del Reino de Dios, is believed to be the largest Pentecostal congregation in the world. Here in the U.S., the church ministers mostly to Latinos. If you've ever found yourself watching Telemundo late at night, then you've probably seen the pastors on TV advertising holy oil and warning you about witchcraft. But the Iglesia Universal has become controversial for the way it preaches what's often called the prosperity gospel. Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop has our report.
Would you like to be rich? Well, luckily, this guy wants you to be rich too. And he has a friend in high places. I'm in a church in Queens, New York. Up front, there's a young pastor, handsome, smartly dressed. He addresses God on behalf of the congregation, speaking Spanish with a thick Portuguese accent.
Dear Lord, when I put my hand on this person's head, you're going to open the door for a new job. This person needs to pay their debts. They need to receive this money.
The Iglesia Universal has more than 6,000 churches spread all over the globe. In the U.S., there are about 100 branches, occupying everything from mini-mall storefronts to former movie palaces. One of the largest churches is here in Queens. The building takes up an entire city block. Although the church is Brazilian, its theology is as American as apple pie.
Tell yourself this. I'm going to make myself rich. I'm not going to have the life my parents had. I won't be poor. I reject being poor. Is it a sin for me to say, God, I want to have a lot?
At the Iglesia Universal, the pastors talk about money all the time. It's a cornerstone of the church's prosperity gospel.
The prosperity gospel is the belief that if you have faith in God, God will make you rich and healthy and grant you all your wishes.
Tony Lin is a research fellow at the University of Virginia and the author of an upcoming book about the prosperity gospel in Latino communities. Forget the traditional Christian notion of poverty and humility. God wants you to be rich. This was a controversial idea at first, but it's become pretty mainstream today. Most TV evangelists and celebrity megapastors preach it in some form. And it may be particularly attractive to Latinos, Lin says, especially newer immigrants.
So instead of staying in the margins, looking at the American dream, the prosperity gospel gives them their own path to the American dream.
According to a 2006 Pew Research study, almost three quarters of all Latino Christians believe in the prosperity gospel.
So the glass ceiling that they had because of their undocumented status, whatever it is, that glass ceiling that they knew they couldn't break on their own, God is going to break for them.
After the sermon, it's time for the ofrenda, the offering. Churchgoers line up and bring envelopes of cash to the altar for donations. The church teaches that a donation is an investment. The more money you give to God, Tony Lin explains, the more God will give you back.
If you want God to pay attention to what you want, you have to give to the point of sacrifice. The extra is what's going to get God's attention.
But that extra might be more than many in Latino communities can afford to give. The Iglesia Universal in particular has attracted controversy for the way it handles its parishioners' money.
The Justice Department has brought charges of money laundering against Bishop Egir Macedo, leader of the Iglesia Universal, and nine other people.
Since its founding in 1977, the church has been investigated many times in various countries. In Brazil, its leaders now are facing charges of money laundering and criminal conspiracy. The prosecutor alleges that founder Ejir Masedu secretly diverted hundreds of millions of dollars of donations, mostly from the poor, into private businesses for his personal gain, and illegally sent church income to foreign bank accounts.
...do Reino de Deus como as principais vítimas. Segundo a promotoria, o dízimo pago todos os meses nos mais de...
The church, meanwhile, maintains that the legal actions against it are politically motivated. A former church website says this: unjustified persecution of innocent Christians for political reasons has been a feature of the last 2,000 years in history. In 2011, the church's New York treasurer pled guilty to charges of falsifying documents in connection with $22 million in mortgage loans. She was convicted, but never served time. Meanwhile, some former members have spoken out about the church's aggressive fundraising practices. One is Victor Velasquez. He left the church after 6 years.
You know, like when you're dating that one girl and you think that she's a good girl, and next thing you know it, she's actually cheating on you with your friends, and it's kind of like that disappointment.
Velasquez first visited the Bronx chapter of the Iglesia Universal at age 17. At first, he says, he really liked how friendly everybody was. Not long after, he became a pastor.
I was in charge of certain services, and I needed to complete a goal. I needed to bring a certain amount of money. And that's when I begin to see that it wasn't as humble as it appeared to be, that it was more, it was a business.
Velasquez says the pastors all lived a little too well. They wore nice clothes and drove big cars. He says the church would buy regular supermarket oil and sell it to believers as holy oil from Israel. And once, he says, he saw the church bishop in New York dip into the collection bag and hand out stacks of $3,000 in cash to a group of pastors with instructions to go out and enjoy the city. But the last straw for him happened during a fundraiser called the Campaign of Israel.
Basically what it is the person has to give all their money, all their possessions, or if you don't have any money in the bank, sell your things, sell your jewelry, sell your clothes, your shoes, and put it in the envelope and give it to the church. And the pastors will go to Israel and supposedly they'll pray for you on the mountains.
Velasquez remembers one campaign of Israel when the bishop fell short of his fundraising goal and directed the pastor to hold another service.
So at that same service, he shut the lights off and he said, whatever you have left, bring it. And I can see members opening up their purses and putting in the altar, and pennies were coming up. Pennies. I mean, and I was so angry that day. I said, you know what? I can't do this no more. You know, this is not right.
Since leaving, Velasquez has been on a one-man truth campaign, posting videos to YouTube that detail what goes on behind closed doors at the church. His stories couldn't be independently verified, but they are in line with what other former members have told the media. I tried to get a response to all this from church leaders, but it wasn't easy. When I asked for an interview, I was referred to a superior and told to come back the next day. None of that surprises Velasquez.
And that's what I'll do when we have a journalist. I'll say, oh, let me speak to the bishop. I'll call the bishop and say, hey, we have a journalist. And he'll say, oh, tell him I'm busy. Okay, he's busy. Come tomorrow.
I made 9 attempts to get an interview at several branches of the church in New York. Finally, an assistant pastor told me, I don't think the bishop wants to speak with you. I also contacted a press officer at church headquarters in Brazil, but my request went nowhere. But the Iglesia Universal did address concerns on its former website. It said all donations go to things like church expenses and pastors' stipends. As to why people give, it said, quote, if this promise to God was proven fruitless, all givers would have then discontinued and the church wouldn't exist today. In other words, if it didn't work, why would people keep giving? After Friday night services in Queens, volunteers serve free tacos and coffee in the church parking lot. One member, Candida Vargas, says she's been doing great ever since she joined the church 3 years ago. She owns a home in New York and 2 other properties back in the Dominican Republic. Does she mind the way they ask for money?
No, I feel good about it, because when I give something to God, I might have nothing, and after I give my offering, a week later, I have double that amount. I don't know how it happens.
Another member, Chris de Jesus, has been attending for 1 year. He says the church cured his insomnia, as well as his mother's Alzheimer's.
My economic situation hasn't changed yet, but I know God is working on it, little by little.
I talked to about a dozen church members, and nearly every person told me their wallets were happier since they joined the church. But few were able to offer specific examples of financial miracles. Victor Velasquez thinks people are deceiving themselves.
I can tell you one thing. Nobody in this church life changes. It doesn't. It's just a lie. It's a deception, you know? And people don't understand that to have success, you have to work hard. You have to get education. You have to save money. You have to invest. But they don't teach them those things. They teach them that giving your money to them is what brings blessings.
There are some documented cases in the U.S. of church members going broke from making outsized donations. In 2000, a woman in Brooklyn filed for bankruptcy after giving almost $80,000 to the church over 3 years. In 1 year alone, she donated almost three quarters of her income. One couple in Houston reportedly lost everything, $60,000 in savings, their cleaning business, their home, their car. They spoke about it to the media and filed a complaint with the Texas Attorney General in 1999. The church responded by suing the couple for slander for $1 million. In the end, Texas decided there were no legal grounds to go after the church since the donations were voluntary. The church eventually dropped its charges against the couple. Still, researcher Tony Lin says most prosperity gospel churchgoers don't fall into such extremes.
They know that they're not going to magically receive money, right? Most of them. But they're in pursuit of a hope. They want the hope to believe that their children will do better than they did. That's all they want. They just want the hope. And in these churches, they're told that they can have that hope.
Everyone wants hope. The question is, at a place like the Iglesia Universal, can everyone afford it? For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop. Porque es tu espíritu quien nos capacita
a conquistar en el nombre de Jesús. Money and religion have always been intertwined, and as a result, it was pretty hard to get both current and former members of the Iglesia Universal to open up to our producer, Marlon Bishop. He spent over a year working to put this report together, and now you join me in the studio, Marlon. What made you be interested in this story of this megachurch?
Well, I had been living in Brazil for a little while, and there it's just everywhere. You see them on every street corner. And I started noticing you saw them elsewhere. All over Latin America, they were there with this message, pare de sufrir, stop suffering. And then I passed one by in Queens, New York, a big one. And I went in one day out of curiosity, and the way the pastor was talking was something I'd never heard of in a church service before. He was talking about money nonstop.
Anyone who's been to church knows that there's always the ask for the donation. There's always the passing of the basket. What makes it different from any church to this church?
The difference is that critics of the Iglesia Universal and prosperity churches like it claim that these are run more like for-profit corporations than nonprofit spiritual organizations. The example of the Iglesia Universal is pretty amazing. I mean, the founder, Edgar Macedo, is estimated to have a $1.1 billion fortune. For comparison, the big mega pastors in the U.S., the Joel Osteens and the T.D. Jakes, have tens of millions of dollars. The Iglesia Universal runs a major political party in Brazil. They own the second largest TV network in Brazil called Hedge Record. And one of the things that's amazing about this church is they're building currently a two-scale model of the biblical Solomon's Temple in Sao Paulo, which will seat 10,000 worshipers. It's 18 stories tall. The Iglesia Universal has become a very powerful entity in Latin America. And the massive wealth that this church has built, many will argue that it was built on the backs of Brazil's working class in ways that are not necessarily ethical.
All right. So the Pew Research Center has done some studies that show that Roman Catholics in the U.S. and in Latin America have actually, and we've heard this before, rapidly been converting to Protestant churches, and that in particular, the prosperity churches are the ones that are showing this phenomenal growth. So is it this notion of come to church and there's a possibility that you're going to get rich as a result? Is that what the attraction is?
For one thing, their motto, Pare de Sufrir, has been read by some as a subtle dig at Catholicism, actually, where it's all about your suffering, right? So here's this place where you can go and you can stop suffering. This is a different concept of religion than many Latinos have grown up with. And what's interesting is that they have this almost marketing strategy where in different countries, they kind of focus on what appeals to those people. In Brazil, they focus a lot on the issues of witchcraft because of traditional Afro-Brazilian religions that are popular. In Argentina, where it has this huge psychotherapy culture, they focus a lot on self-help. This is about self-improvement. And here in the U.S., they focus especially on money and the concept of the American dream.
If believers feel like belonging to the Iglesia Universal really improves their lives, should anyone really be the judge of how much money they're giving?
Well, I've thought about that a lot. Everyone I spoke to who's in the church insisted that their lives have been dramatically improved by the church. But when poor people are being encouraged, even if subtly, to donate large parts of their income to a church in exchange for spiritual help, there are ethical lines that are getting messy. There are some warning signs at this church. For example, they don't do charity work, very little of it. Members are encouraged not to speak with family members who have left the church. And the irony of it is that when a worker who hopes to increase his wealth is donating large portions of his income instead of investing in his future, it actually increases the likelihood that they will not find prosperity, and the American dream will be more difficult to obtain, ultimately.
Great, Marlon. Well, thanks so much for taking an interest on this topic and for your great investigative work on this.
Thank you, Maria.
Marlon Bishop is a reporter based in New York City and a frequent contributor to Latino USA. There are times in our lives so terrifying, so stressful, that the only thing we can do is throw our hands up and pray. Now, the story of a Latina mom who survived a medical emergency with what she believes was divine intervention.
My name is Carla Curiel, and I am a mom living in Miami of twin girls who are 2 years old and were born premature. When I was 23 weeks, my mom and my sister were throwing me a baby shower in Dominican Republic, which is where I'm from. My mom, my dad, my husband, they were all there with me during lunchtime. So we were sitting as a family, and I get one big pain. So I go to the bathroom. I feel that something is coming out, but I just saw this big balloon, white, kind of transparent, filled with water. Imagine a supermarket bag, and it has too much weight, and it just kind of opens up and falls. That's pretty much what was happening to me with my babies. So we ended up going to the hospital, and the doctor found both of my girls' heartbeats, and they were doing great. And the doctor said, if we let nature run its course, your children will be born now, the second, and nobody in the Dominican Republic will be able to save your babies. So I'm going to give you one option. I'm going to do something that is not going to work, but that at least will give you a chance to say that you did everything in your power for these girls. And what he did is that he took my cervix, which was dilated 6 centimeters, and pretty much closed it and stretched it down to stitch it close. And at that point, I was just praying, because he was telling other doctors, I'm going to be pulling, and you need to push them back in, because if you let go, we lose this and they're gone. And what was meant to take only 20 minutes took an hour and a half. And the doctor, my husband says, that came out looking as if he had jumped into a pool with his clothes on and just came out, literally that drenched. He had done something unheard of. So at that point, everything was under control. They kept me under control. And what they did tell me is, you need to get out. Now we bought you some time. Now you need to get back to Miami. When the doctor in Miami saw what had been done to me, he couldn't believe it. He said, you have no idea what this doctor did. This is a miracle. Dr. Rojas bought me 7 weeks, and that 7 weeks bought me unlimited treatment, basically, to develop my girls' lungs. So they were born premature. They were born at 30 and a half weeks, weighing only 2.5 pounds. But those two little girls, they were breathing perfectly on their own. They didn't suffer anything.
Coming up, the Pope is getting all of the attention, but writer Richard Rodriguez says it's all about the women.
But I'm telling you that the wind that is blowing right now is not Pope Francis, but it's the church as a female institution.
Richard Rodriguez coming up. Stay with us on Latino USA. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. I've met a lot of non-Catholics who have faith in the Virgin of Guadalupe. For Mexicans, La Virgen Morena, the Brown Virgin, is their patron saint. According to this story, she appeared to campesino Juan Diego in 1531 on a hill in what is now Mexico City. But more and more, the image of La Virgen is showing up everywhere in El Norte. Here's writer Ray Salazar with a story about how a father explains Our Lady of Guadalupe to a daughter.
When my little girl was 3 years old, she stared at our nativity scene one Saturday afternoon. She asked me, "Papi, why are all the baby Jesus boys?" I responded, "You're right, mija. Little girls can be baby Jesus too." My daughter, I realized, was a feminist, and I her proud pops. When millions of Mexican Catholics celebrate the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe, I contemplate, how can I ensure that I, a progressive Chicano father, contribute to my daughter's feminism and faith? I stopped believing in the Catholic Church for a few years, but I never stopped believing in Our Lady of Guadalupe. She's separate from scandal. She's brown, humble, and unlike the other saints who stare blankly past people requesting intervention at their plaster feet, La Virgen never looks away. She has unwrinkled eyelids and black lashes. Each night, after my little girl prays, she scrunches into her pillow. She closes her luminous eyes, eyes intense as amaryllis blooms. Sitting at her bedside, I ask for the words to explain our faith. Angela, Our Lady of Guadalupe is the image our gente turns to when we need God's help. With a cloak of stars, La Virgen reminds us of the goodness in the universe, even when we cannot find it. Of this goodness, La Virgen reminded me when your grandma fought against an illness. Even as a man with arms strong enough to lift you into the sky, with hands large enough to protect you in an embrace and hold you as if you were only the size of my own heart, I feel scared sometimes. This is when I turn to the image above the roses, when I need to remember the strength of the Mexican women in my life, the women who have always been stronger than the men, and I ask for the courage, the focus, and the faith to persevere. Like most daughters, you too will likely enshrine an image of her papi as a faultless man. I will aspire every day to be that good, so I ask La Virgen to help me be a better man. When you get older and confront injustice, I want you to remember that Our Lady of Guadalupe led farm workers, like your grandpa once was, to demand what they deserved. Decent pay, safe places to work, respect. Chicanas, like your mother, found in this brown-faced saint a self-recognition that helped them redefine a passive faith into images of La Virgen as an independent force. When you see La Virgen, or Tonatzin, her indigenous name, may you always recognize your history. When you see your own image in the mirror, always find your beauty. Remember, in your papi's eyes, you will always be the most beautiful woman in the world. Angela, minutes after you were born, I whispered into your tiny ears the destiny I ask La Virgen to help you fulfill. Welcome to the world, mija. Here you will use your intellect to help lots and lots of people. May Our Lady of Guadalupe bless you, inspire you to believe in her, to believe in yourself, and to remember always how much your papi believes in you.
You know, Ray, I really love your honesty with this commentary. I mean, I love the fact that you're kind of setting the tone for what it is to be a Latino feminist religious man in the year 2014.
And I think that's important for us to remember. We forget as a people sometimes the importance of questioning our faith, of questioning tradition. And what I'm trying to do is instill in my own daughter that confidence and that belief that it's okay to wonder about what we believe and who we are. And it's okay to question so that we can make more sense of who we are as a people, especially in the 21st century.
There's something about La Virgen de Guadalupe that, yeah, it kind of always did communicate power and a particular kind of Mexican feminism.
Well, I think the interesting thing for me is that no matter how distant somebody can get away from the Catholic Church, no matter how much a Mexicano can get away from the Catholic Church, I think that we always keep finding ourselves connected to Our Lady of Guadalupe. And I think part of it is that she's more of a cultural image than she is possibly a religious image. And unlike Jesus, who has all this controversy, and Jesus, who spoke a lot and said a lot, Our Lady of Guadalupe's story is simple, and you know, her image, if we look at it closely, is complex. But the words that we hear repeated over and over that La Virgen said are, "Am I not here? I who am your mother." And I think that's a very different relationship that people establish with her, because we almost see ourselves in her.
There is one thing for sure about this particular Virgen, and that is that everyone knows that she is the brown virgin.
Yes.
That her skin is not white. It never has been.
Yes.
But the whole issue of race, is that of particular importance to you, Ray, in terms of why La Virgen de Guadalupe stands out?
Absolutely.
She's not confused about her racial identity.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think here's her power. I think her power is in her silence, because her simple existence makes many political statements. It pushes people to think of the influence and the power and value of women in our lives. It pushes motherhood. It pushes race. And it puts her in a position of power in our church. And I think it's a way of looking at ourselves and our strength without really saying it. And I think that's something that the Latino tradition, for good or bad, does many times. We don't always talk about what needs to be talked about. Yet we have this image that can push that conversation in subtle ways.
Thanks so much for sharing your essay with us, Ray.
Thank you, Maria.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ray Salazar is a writer at News Taco. He blogs for Chicago Now under the name White Rhino. You can also catch him at the Chicago Public Schools, where he teaches writing. Richard Rodriguez has been a public intellectual for years, as an author, an essayist, and as a contributor to the PBS NewsHour. A controversial and iconoclastic writer, his new book, Darling, a Spiritual Autobiography, is a series of essays about faith, homosexuality, women, and the Catholic Church. He joined us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco.
I have been writing about religion ever since I began writing, and it's something that didn't interest people because they were more interested in my ethnic politics.
But if you think about your relationship and your thoughts around religion and so much that you've written about in terms of your relationship to women, so when you think about the Virgin of Guadalupe, what comes up for you, Richard Rodriguez?
Oh, I think just the liberation that she succeeded giving us from the notion of Spain, that she appears as an Indian speaking the language of an Indian, and she subverts colonialism in an extraordinary way. She sends the Indian to convert the Spanish bishop. That already seems to me to prefigure what we are now seeing, certainly in the United States, where Latin Americans are coming as Protestants and as Catholics, at a time that the United States is declining in its religiosity, are coming to restore Christianity in some way. So that increasingly I find Colombian priests, Venezuelan priests, Mexican priests, the population of Southern Baptists now is increasingly Spanish-speaking. We are seeing something which Guadalupe, I think, anticipates, and that is when she tells Juan Diego to tell the bishop that she wants a church at this spot. She already announces this subversion of colonialism, that the colonized become the colonizers.
You know, yes, people know you because of your writing on ethnic politics, but as a Catholic, as a gay man, you don't ignore the fact that the church, this institution, isn't particularly welcoming to someone like you. In fact, in your title essay of your new book, Darling, you talk about an important dynamic between heterosexual women and homosexual men when it comes to the church. Here's the quote from your essay. It says, "It is because the church needs women that I depend on women to protect the church from its impulse to cleanse itself of me. So yes. women in the church making sure that you as a gay man are not thrown out of the church.
You know, one of the things that everyone is so enthusiastic about Pope Francis, and one of the earliest comments that he made that attracted so much attention, that the church was paying too much attention to, he said, abortion and gay marriage. What he did not say was why the church is paying so much attention to abortion and gay marriage. Well, I think because what women are increasingly challenging the church about has to do with whether or not women are simply mothers, whether or not women have any role in the world other than to increase the tribe. That was the role that the desert religions give women, the notion of increasing the tribe, of being generative. And now I think I dated with the 19th century, with the beginning of the modern feminist movement, the seeking of the vote outside the family house, the woman who wants an identity, not as a mother, not as a wife, but as a citizen. That movement out of the house, out of the parlor, anticipates my own freedom out of the closet. Because what the church has not given me, and I don't say this simply about Catholicism. Obviously, I would say this about Islam or about many forms of Judaism. What the church, these churches still do not give us, is the freedom to be free of the responsibility to increase the number of the tribe, that I would be in love with another man, and that love was not generative in the eyes of the church. That's the great scandal of our homosexuality, that a woman would have an abortion, would curtail the reproductive cycle. That's the great scandal of the church. What I wanted to do in writing Darlene was I wanted to talk really about how I have been influenced by this church, by women in this church, by Irish nuns in this church, who were the first feminists in my life, who were operating quite apart from family, they weren't married. They moved about in the city. They created hospitals, schools, orphanages as early as the 19th century. They become for me the model of a new kind of civilization. But I'm telling you that the wind that is blowing right now is not Pope Francis, but it's the church as a female institution.
Richard, you are a thinker. This is what you do. You write, you think, but was it something of a revelation for you to say, oh my God, my relationship to women is key? Was it a revelation, or were you just like, you know what, I've always wanted to talk about this, I've always wanted to write about this?
No, it was a revelation. I think I began thinking about, when I wrote the chapter, Darling, I began to think that I was going to write a gay apology for myself as a Christian, how it is that I live in an institution that in some official way rejects me. But what happened with that chapter is I began to think about the women in my life, is that in some way it seemed to me that my life was part of their lives in a larger way, that their story of their own emancipation, their own anxiety about their relationship to this religion, which in some way diminishes them as women in relationship to men. It seemed to me that that Darlene took the book away from me, and in some larger way, it's no coincidence at the end of the book, Mother Teresa goes to heaven. I have this vision of her at the very close of the book. It's that I wanted this book to be a celebration of women, and that was a surprise. It came to me many times in writing. You start writing one essay, and then the essay rewrites you in some way. And that's what happened in this instance.
Richard Rodriguez, thank you so much for all of your work, for all of your thoughts, and for all of your writing. We really appreciate it. And thank you so much for being on Latino USA.
Thank you very much.
Richard Rodriguez joined us from KQED in San Francisco. His new book, Darling, A Spiritual Autobiography, is available now. As you know, mis queridos, I like to end each show with some words of wisdom to send you off. This month, we're partnering with the magazine Culture Strike to bring you a special Sabiduría series that we're calling Sabiduría, the Poetry Edition. Every week this month, we'll hear from a different Latino poet talking about their craft, and we'll feature readings of their work on our website. This week, Pat Mora, an award-winning author of poetry, nonfiction, and children's books.
I have spent most of my life in the U.S. Southwest, in particularly the Chihuahuan Desert. However, I did live in the Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky area for about 11 years. And the whole time I was there, I would say to myself, well, one day you will look back and figure out what you learned. And I learned how much I missed the sound of Spanish. I remember once in Cincinnati being at a store and a gentleman behind me began to speak in Spanish, and I turned around to him and I said, oh, I could just give you a big hug porque le he hecho tantos menos al español. For many years, for complex reasons, I did not write. And that was, you know, because I was working, because I was raising three children, and also because initially when I submitted work, there were such quick rejections. And as I often say to students, because I had never seen a writer who looked like me, who was bilingual. And I think that all of that meant that when I finally could write, and I joke about this, I always feel like I'm playing hooky. I get a little giddy about it because it's like a gift. Because I write for sort of all ages, I find myself often telling how blessed I feel to be bilingual. Just last week, I was in Boston at a school that was totally bilingual, and I was saying to them that when I visit college campuses, you know, college students will say to me, oh, I wish that I had another language that I could layer into my poetry the way you can do Spanish. So it is such a part of me that just as monolinguals will say to me, I can't imagine having two languages in my head, I respond, I can't imagine having only one.
You can hear Pat Mora reading a selection of her poems on our website at latinousa.org. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Jonathan Wolf, Eva DeLapp, and Antonia Cerejido. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to KQED in San Francisco. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And you can check out my Instagram at Maria_La_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Oh, we don't air at Latino USA.
You don't?
No.
Are you kidding me? We're in Miami.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.